Thank you all for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff with the Atlas Society with our founder David Kelly and senior scholar Richard Salzman on how narcissism isn't egoism. And while they're offering their thoughts, feel free to raise your hands with questions. We'll bring you up to the stage to ask once they're done with their opening statements. We encourage you to share the room. Thank you both for doing this topic. David, I think we're going to start with you. Help us with the distinction between narcissism and egoism.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, everyone. Thanks to Richard.
Your volume, we're still having issues with your volume. I tell you what, Richard, would you be okay starting while David fixes his audio issues?
Sure, Scott. Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
And when David...
Let me just check. Can I hear you?
Yeah, we still can hardly hear you, David. I think you're probably going to have to leave, take out any kind of headphones or microphones and just come back.
Okay, Scott, when David comes back, if I don't hear him and others do, just stop me midstream. I'll take up. David and I have been studying this for a long time. The topic, we think is, topical. And here's what we intended to do tonight. One, narcissism, just a cultural issue. Has it changed over time? We've delved into many, many, both academic and popular accounts of this, and there's a lot of material on this. It's all very interesting. Our overall goal has been to distinguish narcissism from egoism, and objectivism being an egoistic, having an egoistic ethic and a rational egoism as the key ethic, which itself is a minority view. We want to distinguish it from narcissism in various ways. So the structure really we had today after all our reading and studying and back and forth behind the scenes was first narcissism to the extent a current cultural issue. Then what is it? What is narcissism? And then start to distinguish it. What is egoism and why narcissism is not that? And then I think we're going to make a very important point about why narcissism is not simply too much self-esteem or too much egoism, meaning we're going to stress that it's not a quantitative issue, it's a qualitative issue. This is a difference not of degree, but of kind, of type. And if our ethic is right and rational egoism is the right way to go, we need to be very careful about not letting it be contaminated by conceptions which amount to pseudo self-esteem or pseudo egoism, which we think narcissism is. Now, the other thing, there are certain other auxiliary points worth making that we'll make as well. One of them is that on a certain level, and the research bears this out, narcissism could be seen somewhat innocuously in an innocuous manner as simply arrested development. Most of the research on this, especially those who very carefully and interestingly try to distinguish between narcissism and self-esteem, indicate that early on, and this is child development stuff, the child tends to be narcissistic because their universe is very circumscribed. Their universe is basically their parents or their family. And so they're very centered on their own universe and aren't yet capable to see beyond themselves, so to speak. But most of the studies have shown that over time, and then very quickly after childhood, narcissism declines and self-esteem rises. And so there's an inverse relationship between the two. And by self-esteem, they do mean a genuine internal, not external, internally generated sense of, well, two things in the objectivist literature, self-efficacy and self-worth. So... I'll stop here for a minute. David, can you hear or speak? I don't want to keep going if you're able to speak.
I can hear. Can you hear me?
Faintly.
It's still barely. Faint.
Yeah, still faint.
I'm sorry. I don't know what the problem is.
You were able to fix it last time, so.
Yeah, I'm going to restart my phone. It's a new phone, and I haven't mastered all the limitations and gimmicks. So let me come back. Richard, you're doing great.
okay, Dave.
I will be back shortly, as shortly as possible.
Yeah, we'll see you back shortly.
So this last point was that narcissism, in effect, is the impoverished self, or call it arrested development, that for some reason in childhood and then going into adolescence and adulthood, the person does not transition very quickly into genuine self-esteem. And this could be due to parenting, it could be due to education in the public schools or whatever, but the idea is... narcissism, to the extent defined as very internally focused with no conception of the outside world, as we'll see in the actual definitions, clinical and otherwise, in the literature, there is a preoccupation actually with what others think of you. But if narcissism is conceived, as many do, as completely self-centered, completely oblivious to the outside world, that's not quite the view of the child because they see the parents, but the parents are the sole universe, the sole outside world, so to speak. They very quickly transition into, well, others exist, and now I have to find my place in the world relative to others. But this is the idea that it's possible that narcissism, and there are various types of narcissism, that one of them is simply a kind of understandable, albeit pathetic, but still understandable attempt by someone rising into adulthood, not really fully self-esteem, trying to buttress and bolster their self-esteem as if they glimpse it is important, but they don't quite have it. And is there some way they can gain it externally? So it's still a mistake. It's still wrong, but it's, at least from our perspective, still understandable because you'd rather that, of course, than someone who wishes to be completely selfless. You know, a complete cipher. All right, so that's our basic structure. And David and I were thinking of going for at most 40 minutes. We have a 90-minute session, 40, 45 minutes, maybe less, and then leave it open to comments and questions. And unless David wants to jump in, let me go back to the structure. Culturally, why is it a current issue? I mean, if you just say things like social media, people who have friends who aren't really friends, people who get likes on Twitter and other things, followers, eyeballs, you know, sheer eyeballs. It's the idea that I'm self-important because others are following me. And there's almost no distinction between, well, who are these others? David and I have talked at length about the idea that, well, it's not completely irrational to want admiration from others, but these would be others that we prize. These would be others that the rational person esteems and respects. Say, we often hear the respective peers who know what they're doing, who know what they're talking about. And that is an objective basis. That isn't craving the esteem of just anyone promiscuously or sheer numbers, if sheer numbers would do it. No, it's the quality of those who judge us, judge our work, judge our relationships. And so that's healthy, but that's not narcissism. We know that the narcissist is almost promiscuous about the number and types of people who, quote, follow him or follow her. Social media would be one phenomenon. Reality TV would be another phenomenon. Real Housewives of the, I don't know, fill in the blank would be another phenomenon. If Harry and Meghan, oh my God, I can't even... There are so the Oprah, now Oprah's not active anymore, but those Oprah shows where people would come on and they would just spill their guts and as if anyone cared about their inner workings and that whole trend and I'm sure you can think of others is narcissistic in the sense that these people are craving in a very kind of irrational, almost pathetic way the approval, the esteem of others. Our colleague at the Atlas Society, Rob Trzynski, wrote an interesting piece recently about the crisis, what he called the crisis of self-esteem. And that's part of our theme tonight as well. Namely, a part of it is people do not really understand what self-esteem amounts to. And in the objectivist philosophy, reason, purpose, and self-esteem are the three cardinal values that Ayn Rand lays out in her Ethics. Now, this is apart from the seven virtues in her Ethics, but the Ethics is a means of gaining these values, of keeping these values, maintaining these values. So self-esteem is very important to the philosophy. And of course, it would be if you have a philosophy that's main ethic is a rational egoism. So I think it's a culture, well, I haven't even mentioned Trump. I think it's culturally interesting. I don't want to psychoanalyze Trump, but it's probably not in dispute that here is a president who has many narcissistic features. And you have to admit that yet he was elected and has a great following. So people either like this, which is itself interesting, or they don't like it and vote for him anyway. But the phenomenon itself, the idea that it would be manifest in a president to this extent is interesting. By the way, it's not as if studies have not been done. They have been done. There's a study by Hardin we came across, H-A-R-D-I-N. Hardin studied the various presidents, going back, I think, to Teddy Roosevelt, who himself was classified as a narcissist. The list is interesting because Hardin, an academic, if you look at the calculations he does, and the measurements here are in dispute to some degree, but it's interesting that most, other than Teddy Roosevelt, who was a Republican, most of the presidents who ranked high in narcissism were Democrats, starting with FDR and Wilson and others. And most of the non-narcissists were Republicans, including people like Reagan and Coolidge and others, those of seemingly more passive, confident, genuinely confident personality. Okay. Now, let's move to... David, go ahead.
Still can't hear you, really. You want to test with Lawrence in another room while Richard's finishing up?
I'm sorry. Say again, Scott.
I was going to suggest testing with Lawrence in a different room while Richard's finishing up his presentation. He can invite you, but let's try that. Go ahead, Richard.
Let's turn now to what is narcissism. First of all, let's not forget that narcissism, the word itself, comes from a Greek mythological figure, Narcissus. And not to go too deeply into the story, but it's interesting from the standpoint of examining this. Narcissus becomes enamored in the story of his own image in a pond. And the long and short of it is, it ruins him. So prior to this, he's got admirers, he's got potential lovers. I think Echo, look for Echo in this story. She's a great character in this story, and Echo is trying to get his attention and to no avail because for the first time, kind of reminds me of Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, who's the fairest of them all? And that's Narcissus, and it ruins his life. He is so preoccupied with his own image, he cannot literally carry on his life. So I think it's interesting just from the standpoint of, you can always remember that, of course. It's a reminder that this is not a rational approach to life. Now, people are more or less narcissistic, so they still survive. I mean, Trump became president. So it's not like it incapacitates you in the sense that narcissists incapacitated himself, but to the extent you're a narcissist, you're going to incapacitate yourself and make yourself unable to live and live well and live happily. Now, David and I, in this case, what is narcissism? I mean, we went right to the basic sources. We got the Mayo Clinic is one. We have the DSM, known as the Diagnostic Manual of Mental Disorders, the 5th edition. By the way, we should be clear, David is a philosopher, a fabulous one. I'm a political economist. We are not psychologists. On the other hand, we're pretty good at researching things. And we've been watching this issue and looking at this issue for a long time. So take that for what it is. I'm sure there is psychologists and psychiatrists out there who know way more than we do. And if we're misstating any of this, by all means, chime in. But here's what we found in terms of traits, usually, with the acronyms are Narcissistic Personality Disorder. That would be NPD. There's something also called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory. By the way, separately, as far back as the mid-60s, Rosenberg developed something called the Self-Esteem Scale. And critiques of that had to do with the fact that they were self-reporting. I mean, they would ask people in surveys, well, you know, what do you think of yourself and your capacities? Well, you can imagine the methodological problems associated with that. If the people have fake self-esteem to begin with, they're going to answer the questions in such a way that make themselves look good to the questioner. So there's been lots of critiques of that, but give these psychiatrists and psychologists and researchers credit for trying to bring metrics to the phenomenon. But and regarding NPD, Narcissistic Personality Disorder, let me just give you some of those. And this is right off of, if you want to look for this, the Mayo Clinic website. People with NPD can now have an unreasonably high sense of self-importance. Now, unreasonably itself should be an alert to, well, it's not tethered in reality. It's not reasonable. It's not realistic. It's not rational. And that does not certainly square with rational egoism. Now, high sense of self-importance, self-efficacy and the idea that you feel important or you feel efficacious is important, of course. But it also says, now I'm quoting, requiring constant, excessive admiration, unquote. Now, the first thing to ask there is admiration. Well, guess what? Admiration from others. So it's other-oriented, and it doesn't specify who these others are. That's what I meant before about the idea of that, well, this seems like it could be promiscuous. This is not just significant others, others that you independently have indicated are valuable to you, and therefore you prize their judgment. That's okay. Now, excessive, and then the idea of excessive, like unearned, unjustified admiration from others. All right, here's another one. Quote, feel that they deserve privileges and special treatment, unquote. Now, first thing I thought of here was VIPs, very important persons. You know, they get valet parking, they get special treatment. And again, the idea of privileges, something others wouldn't get. If you really had a core sense of self-confidence and that it was deserved, why would you care whether you had special privileges and special treatment from others? Here's a third one from Mayo. Expect to be recognized as superior even without achievements, unquote. I'm just quoting from Mayo. Now, this is the whole idea of superior, inferior. David and I have signified as very interesting because it is kind of a relativistic approach, right? Here's the narcissist here. The idea is my value comes from my comparing myself to others and ranking myself. And not even ranking objectively, like, you know, you could objectively say you're the smartest guy in the room, so to speak. No, it's this idea of I'm superior or I'm inferior. The obsession you can see is ranking with others. But the idea that it goes on and says, even without achievements, unquote, is quite interesting. So who could be a better judge of themselves than oneself, right? You can easily fool others. But the one judging themselves without achievements and still feeling superior is so pathetic. It's so obviously unjustified. It's the unearned. And the unearned is fundamentally unjust. And justice is one of the seven great virtues Ayn Rand identified, right? So is this not all of self-esteem? And this whole debate really is an issue of not just judging others, but judging yourself. What could be more important than judging yourself objectively? Warts and all, as they say. Warts and all. The good and the bad for purposes of improvement. Anyway, all right, here's another one on the list. Quote, those who make achievements and talents seem bigger than they are, unquote. Now, again, seem bigger. Seem bigger to who? To outsiders. You can't fool yourself. Well, some people are self-delusional, but self-delusion is actually part of the narcissistic approach. But again, you see the other-oriented part of it. All right, here's another one. Quote, tend to be preoccupied with fantasies about success, power, the perfect mate, unquote. Well, fantasy world is not real world, is it? Again, so the themes you're seeing here are unreality, not tethered to facts, and other-oriented. Other-oriented being, I mean, altruism literally means other-ism. So any kind of obsession with others and what others think of you is not an egoistic ethic, but an altruistic approach. A couple of others, just quickly, be critical of and look down on people they feel are not important. So some of the literature shows that narcissists are not very good at empathizing with others, dealing with others. So they always feel like they're in competition with others, and specifically wanting to debase others, not because others deserve debasement, but because it makes the inferior narcissist feel superior. Here's another one. Well, I said this just now, quote, but I want to anchor it to the Mayo definitions, quote, have an inability or unwillingness to recognize the needs and feelings of others, unquote. This is what's sometimes called the no empathy trait. Now, here's another one that might be interesting to objectivists, quote, they tend to be, quote, envious of others and believe others envy them, unquote. Now, envy and objectivism is a very bad thing. it's not just jealousy. Oh, I would like to have what others have. Let me emulate them. And now envy entails a desire to destroy. If I can't have it, they ain't going to have it. And also, interestingly, to believe that others envy them, unquote, is a very malevolent attitude, isn't it? If you had a benevolent attitude toward others, you would respect their achievements. You wouldn't feel inferior if they were objectively superior. And you wouldn't assume the worst in them, that they're out to get you. Here's another one, a couple more. One, quote, behave in an arrogant way, brag a lot, and come across as conceited, unquote. Sometimes called supercilious, sometimes sanctimonious. David and I talked about this for a while. To be arrogant, arrogant is sometimes defined as overconfidence. In other words, once again, unjustified confidence. So it's not that self-confidence is bad, but arrogance is like unjustified self-confidence. Again, unjustified, like based on the facts. And arrogant, the root, interesting, is arrogate. If you say somebody arrogates something, they really basically take something. In an unwarranted way. Okay, I'm not going to... That's enough from the Mayo Clinic. So if you just look up the Mayo Clinic and these various traits, I think you'll see the beginnings of why this is not fundamentally egoism in the sense of Ayn Rand's conception of it. And by the way, those of you who are not familiar with objectivism, the key book here is Ayn Rand's The Virtue of Selfishness. 1964, and the subtitle, which people usually forget, A New Concept of Egoism. Now, why would she use that, the idea of the new concept? That the old concepts, if you will, the Nietzschean view of egoism as the, you know, the beast who runs roughshod over others, who sacrifices others to themselves, in contradistinction, say, to the... the Christian view that you are selfless and that you sacrifice yourself for others. And so she wants a new concept of egoism. She develops that, and the key here is tying it to reason and rationality. You know, Nietzsche, we all know that Nietzsche devoted it and based it on feelings, urges, the will to power. These are all non-rational or irrational ways of going at egoism. So to put it negatively, narcissism is not egoism. But the question is, what is egoism? And this audience will know most of Ayn Rand's argument, but it starts with this idea that you are to be the beneficiary of your own actions. When you hear that, she said it this way too, she said, when you hear that, it doesn't sound negative at all. Why do people take self-interest and self-love and selfishness, the word they give it, as a necessarily evil thing? It's because, she says, of this false presumption that sacrifice is unavoidable in human affairs And then the only question is, will you be the sacrificial animal or will others? And she says, how about no sacrifice? How about we not act like animals and rather act like humans, meaning we have reason, the capacity for reason. Our self-interest is not automatic, by the way. That's one of the caricatures of egoism, that it's automatic, that everybody unavoidably, whatever the hell they choose and do, are being self-interested. Not so. People can be self-destructive. So pursuing your self-interest requires learning, discovering what that self-interest is. And there's no real proper way to do that unless you use reason. You can't take a public opinion poll or ask your friends, preachers, and teachers. Well, you can if they're reasonable, but... So, a little more on what egoism is. It requires, obviously, rationality. Rationality is the main virtue in Ayn Rand's ethics. The narcissist basically has a non-rational, a non-objective concept of his worth. And it's worth, I think, saying something about what in the literature is described as the durability or lack of, the lack of being an instability of self-esteem. Now, they don't quite understand self-esteem in the way Ayn Rand did, but they're interested in how the narcissist, they'll say, seems to have a very kind of fickle, ephemeral a sense of importance. In other words, it fluctuates up and down depending on daily events. Well, you could see why this would happen. If you have external sources basically driving your self-worth, then disapproval from others or setbacks in your career or breakups in your romance, it will crush you. And you won't have like an internal core, an unshakable internal core that doesn't move regardless of the contingencies of the world. But to the narcissist, they do, and they must, because their source of self-worth is external. And as I said before, not just external to rationally, objectively demonstrable people, but to anyone, any and all comers. Just give me more eyeballs. And if I lose followers, man, I'm going to have a bad day and feel badly about myself. That is just ridiculous. But that's the narcissist. So not to bring in other psychologies here, but the bipolar personality, the manic depressive, up one day, down the next, that's the narcissist. But that's not a core self-esteem, genuine self-esteem approach, is it, or issue, is it? By the way, David?
I'm trying to get back. All right, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, David, now I have to tell you, your voice is beautiful and hearable, and the dulcet tones.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to stop, David, because you're probably dying to get in here, but I hope I've kept up my end for a while here. But we hear you loud and clear. You sound great.
Okay. Thanks, Richard, and you've been doing a great job. You know, we had an outline and that we developed, and we've talked so much back and forth over the last couple of weeks in preparation for this that we kind of thought we'd continue as some sort of kind of a conversation too for at least our part of it.
Yeah,
Richard, I wanted to say a bit about more about self-esteem, if Good. Unless you've covered the Brandon part of the discussion.
Yes, go ahead. I have not done that yet. I was going to turn to that aspect of our outline. So yeah, you're talking about.
Okay.
For those who don't know, basically page 2 of our outline, right, David? We're looking at it ourselves. Yes, I haven't done that yet.
Right. Okay. I don't think we've shared the outline with everyone. But anyway, the point here is that narcissism is not, it's often described as excessive self-esteem.
Hmm.
And that is just wrong on a couple of reasons. But let's start with what self-esteem is. I think Brandon gave the best account of this in, or the best summary in his book, The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. He says, self-esteem is the disposition to experience oneself as competent to cope with the basic challenges of life and as worthy of life. That is, competent to live my own life and worthy of pursuing my own life. He continues, it is an intimate experience. It resides in the core of one's being. It's what I think and feel about myself, not what someone else thinks or feels about me. So the difference between narcissism and self-esteem is not one of degree or inflated self-esteem. It's qualitative on two counts. One is that self-esteem are your internal convictions about yourself, not what anyone else thinks about you. It's not external. The sources are not external. Now, children growing up, you know, for a while need their parents to be intermediaries between the child and reality, including the reality of the child's self. So, you know, some degree of support and nurturing is appropriate, but in a mature adulthood, self-esteem is your view of yourself. It's internal. And the second thing is that it has to be earned by living in accordance with objective standards. Narcissists depend on assessments by other people and comparisons with them, whatever the standards of those people are. They're second-handers, broadly speaking, to use an objectivist term that Brandon developed. These differences are, as I said, qualitative. They're not quantitative. Pride or self-esteem is distinguished qualitatively from two opposites. Pride means earned esteem for yourself. Narcissism and humility are both failures in that regard, because an earned self-esteem for oneself has to be based on your actually character, actions, and choices in life, and your values, what you have done, what you have made of yourself, and by a rational standard. Narcissism is rejects the objective standard and goes by what others think of you. So it's just not in the same ballpark as self-esteem. And the same is true of the opposite, humility. That's often considered the opposite of narcissism and too little self-esteem. But the person of humility lacks self-esteem because he can't judge himself. He's not sufficiently cognitively aware of himself, or maybe he is and just has failed to live up to standards. So the qualitative difference here is stark from the standpoint of a correct, you know, rational standard of interest, a standard of value. Just as a sidebar, some of you are familiar with Aristotle's view of a virtue like pride or the pursuit of self-esteem, as Aristotle's view of virtue as a mean between extremes. And indeed, he talks about what we would call pride. He calls it the Grits old man. And he says it is the means between humility and narcissism, or his word is vanity. This is a better analysis than many philosophically, but it's quantitative. Notice that it's quantitative. Pride is the means between two extremes. And what we're saying is that that's not the case. It's distinguished qualitatively. So that is, I think, the essential point to be made about self-esteem. Richard, we also have on our list to talk about the deeper analysis, the kind of impoverished self that some psychologists have said lies behind narcissism. You want to go into that? How's our time doing?
We are 35 minutes into it, so maybe 10 or 15 minutes. Scott, does that sound right?
Yeah, about 10. I want to start opening up the audience questions by about 6:45.
All right, let's. All right, so let's finish it up with this. Let me, David. Let me give you about 5 minutes, and then I want to go back to you because I want to hear more from you. But there, David located, and Rob Trzynski located, by the way, just to cite a very good essay from Darlene Lancer in Psychology Today. I believe this is a popular. I've read it. It's a popular account, but a very good one. Understanding the Mind of a Narcissist. Now listen to this, because this is very close to what David and I and Rob would say. Quote, despite having a seemingly strong personality, narcissists lack a core self. Their self-image and thinking and behavior are other-oriented in order to stabilize and validate their self-esteem and fragile, fragmented self. Wow. Quote, it's a common misconception that they love themselves. They may actually dislike themselves immensely. I'm still quoting here, their inflated self-flattery, perfectionism, and arrogance are merely covers for the self-loathing they don't admit, usually even to themselves. Instead, it's a projected, it's projected outward in their, in their disdain for and criticism of others. They're too afraid to look at themselves because they believe the truth would be devastating. Emotionally, they may be dead inside and hungering to be filled and validated by others. By the way, there's a famous book. It's been around quite a while, but to give you this, the sense of what David and I are kind of rejecting, well, explicitly rejecting, Sam Vakman, very many years ago, wrote of narcissism. Now get this, malignant self-love. So what's the opposite of malignant, David? Benign? We're talking about tumors here or something.
Yeah, right.
Isn't it? It is interesting, isn't it? Because it captures this error we think of. Well, there's versions of self-love. There's malignant and we're saying, well, that this is not self-love at all. And as Darlene Lancer points out, it's self-loathing. By the way, I think there's a parallel here to another key objectivist concept, capitalism. So when we hear words like crony capitalism or state capitalism or stakeholder capitalism, why do we resist so much? Because words should mean something. And when you start bringing in adjectives that contaminate and confuse the matter, that's not good. Conceptual confusion is very bad for human well-being and happiness. So similarly here, though, you know, as David pointed out, the idea that these are alleged versions of egoism, too much egoism or too much self-confidence, or it's self-love but malignant, is a very wrong way of going about it, and hurts our cause, if you will, in terms of conceptual clarity.
I just want to, Richard, let me add to that.
Yes,
you mentioned Vakman's book, Malignant Self-Love. He invokes a concept that is was discussed a while back in psychology, not so much anymore, although he's an exception, between a true self and a false self, resulting in this analysis by the true self being developed from childhood, when the self has felt vulnerable to excessive demands by parents or neglect by parents or whatever. And then a false self is what the child learns to project to the world. And Vakman says something really interesting. He says, there's a major difference between one's true self and reflected self. Loving your true self is healthy, adaptive, and functional. Loving a reflection, that is, a false self, has two major drawbacks, and this is important. One depends on the existence and availability of the reflection to produce the emotion of self-love. But what if you're getting negative feedback from people? But secondly, hear this, the absence of a compass, an objective and realistic yardstick by which to judge the authenticity of a reflection. In other words, it's impossible to tell whether the reflection is true to reality, and if so, to what extent. The popular misconception is that narcissists love themselves. In reality, they direct their love at other people's impressions of them. And so I think this is worth considering. As Richard said, neither of us are psychologists, and so we're not deeply immersed in all the research and theorizing, but we are, you know, philosophically knowledgeable objectivists, and with a conception of ethics and of the aspects of human nature that lie behind the ethical principles. And so I find this plausible in terms of the analysis of what narcissism is, and also, you know, honestly, from my own experience of people.
Yeah, and I would add, David, just in terms of sources that we might recommend, Mollen, M-O-L-L-O-N, there's an interesting, really interesting 1993 book, but notice the title, The Fragile Self, subtitled The Structure of Narcissistic Disturbance. Again, he's not an objectivist, but that's a pretty good account. Here's another one more recently, 2008, Bosson, B-O-S-S-O-N et al., Untangling the Links Between Narcissism and Self-Esteem. There, David and I were pleasantly surprised to find a lot of good academic work on distinguishing exactly what we're trying to distinguish tonight, narcissism versus self-esteem. And another good one is Brummelman, B-R-U-M-M-E-L-M-A-N. He often co-authors, but Brummelman is, I think, is from Netherlands. One of them, 2016, Separating Narcissism from Self-Esteem. Another one, How to Raise a Child's Self-Esteem. And that one particularly says make sure they're not narcissists. Now, David and I have also noticed that they do not ever cite Nathaniel Brandon. And we're not quite sure why. We think it's somewhat of an injustice. But to the extent that the academics will only cite things that appear in academic journals, that was not Brandon's forte. But in justice, David, would you agree that it is undeniable that Nathaniel Brandon had a lot to do with the self-esteem movement? I think in our own studies and revisiting this, the kind of concepts that he and Ayn Rand came up with that are relevant to tonight are things like pseudo self-esteem. There's a whole section, there's a whole multi-page section called pseudo self-esteem in his book called The Psychology of Self-Esteem from 1968. And of course, many of those essays were edited by Ayn Rand when they were together. Another one, if you look up the concept, counterfeit individualism. I don't have it in front of me, but I believe counterfeit individualism is one of the essays in The Virtue of Selfishness. It's by Brandon. Another one would be his concept of social metaphysics. Again, not quite narcissism, but again, the idea that we get our reality not from reality, but from what other people think and do and what they think of us. And then obviously second-handers, Ayn Rand's concept of a second-hander. If you go online and look in the Ayn Rand lexicon and just put in second-hander, there are many excerpts from her books, including The Fountainhead, having to deal with that. So those are, you know, either closely related, tangentially related to our topic, right, David? And we're, you know, worth examining, worth studying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just add that The Fountainhead is almost a textbook about narcissism, although she does not use the word. In fact, Rand only uses the word once that I could find, and that was in talking about her review of B.F. Skinner. In any case, but yes, look at Peter Keating versus Howard Rourke. We have a number of examples. Maybe we'll get to in the question period. But that is, you know, where the second-hander and the other directed person are versus the self-sufficient, the prime mover, so to speak, are the differences most dramatically illustrated and shown in concrete, albeit fictional, detail. So anyway, maybe we should stop here. And open the question period.
Great. And as David said, David and I came across, we were both reminded of the very early scene in The Fountainhead where Peter Keating is graduating from Stanton Institute. And there is a hilarious three-page account of a narcissistic Peter. And but we'll leave it to the Q&A. If it's interesting in the Q&A, I'll quote from it. but otherwise I won't. Yeah, agreed. Thank you, David. Boy, I love working with you on this. This was wonderful. This is great.
Good.
Yeah, same here.
Thank you both for that great opening. I've got questions, but we've got people coming to the stage. We've got Northern 2023. Thanks for joining.
Hello. Thanks for bringing me up. I have a question. I just joined. I'm not sure. Maybe you already discussed this, but I encountered this question many times. Every time I spoke of to people of objectivism and objective values, they believe me. They believe me. They just start to accuse me of narcissism, and you know, label me that, oh, this is so. This. What is the best answer we can give them? You know, just to differentiate. What is exactly how? That the difference between egoism, rational egoism, and narcissism, apart from that, narcissism is a psychological state. Thanks so much. Yeah.
I would say one thing is to ask them what they mean by narcissism. And if they give an account of it, that's anything like the one we give and that most psychologists would give, then ask, well, how does that apply to me? I'm being rational. Narcissists are not rational. And work from there. Usually, I think it's because people say, you know, if you're pursuing your self-interest, it must be at the expense of other people. You're not being a social, socially responsible. That's a deeper question that we touched on, Richard did. We believe in a system of trade. We don't exploit people. We believe in win-win situations. But, I mean, you can go down all kinds of paths from that.
Yeah, and I would add, David, that that's a really very good question. I first thought of it as he wants an elevator pitch. That's what we usually call. Give me a 15-second... synopsis of what we just said so you could dismiss someone at a cocktail party or something. Well, we don't want to dismiss people. We want to engage them. But no, that's a good question because that means we've essentialized it. I think if I face this challenge, I think the first thing I would do is say, by the way, did you know that narcissist himself was incapacitated because he was so inward looking that he had no life. It ruined his life. But getting beyond mythology, I think the difference here is it's not that people don't know what narcissists are. I don't know. David and I have not talked about it this way, but it's that they don't know what rational egoism is. So if you said to them, oh, by narcissism, you must mean these people who are so insecure. Here's my elevator pitch. You mean by narcissists, those people who are so insecure internally, really, that they need validation from others. They need constant affirmation and approval from others, and they don't really have a realistic sense of their worth. The person would be nodding, I think, the whole time. And then if you say to them, but by the way, that is not really rational. That is not really, you need to judge yourself, not just others. You need to judge yourself above all, objectively, realistically, the good and bad of it. If you're going to live your life and improve your life and be done with, and that's it. And that's a big difference, isn't it? I think they might see that.
That's thank you so much. Yeah. I think we need to just refer them to the fact instead of people's opinion. This is what David said. That yeah. They are, it's yeah. Not rational. And the second point that David said, it's so illustrative, really said that, The narcissist people, they do it at people's price. So ego is pay the price. They don't. Yeah, this is a really good point. Thank you so much, David and Richard.
Thank you, David and I thank both. You. David and I.
Because in the midst of start talking to you, I heard Star's voice cracking.
Sorry about that. Go ahead, Richard.
I just wanted to say briefly, David and I also discovered types of narcissism. And one is very internal and kind of quiet and reserved and doesn't abuse others. And the other one is outwardly and ridiculing others to support and buttress their position. So just so you're aware of that, there are these kind of, I don't know how you'd classify it, David, quiet narcissists who seem not to bother anybody. But then the bombastic outward narcissists who are people know more about because they see them. That's just worth distinguishing.
Richard, the quiet ones are typically called vulnerable narcissists.
Yeah.
And again, they have, you know, a very impoverished self.
Yeah.
But it's more reflected in what we would often call passive aggressive behavior toward others. It's still hostile to others.
Yeah.
Let's get Raymond in here if we can. Raymond, thank you for waiting. Are you? You have to unmute by hitting the microphone button. There you go.
There we go. Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can. Hi, Ray.
Hey, Ray.
Hey, guys. I'm glad to hear be a part of it. I really enjoyed the discussion so far by Richard and David. I just want to add one piece here that I think you guys were alluding to or getting to, but
maybe get slightly closer to your mic.
Okay. How's this?
Better.
Okay. So I just want to add one piece that is consistent with what was said so far, but just another way of seeing it is it might be easier for some people to capture. I think one way to think of narcissism is everyone has to have self-esteem. It's a basic human need, self-esteem and pride, some version of feeling good about yourself. And then if you reach a certain age or adulthood and you don't have objective measures or have a sense of stability and feeling good about yourself, or you're not sure what to base it on, then you start looking for alternative means to feel good about yourself, because you got to feel good about yourself. Or at least most people would search for something. And that, you know, there are multiple ways that people can do this, but one way is they turn toward narcissism, because it's sort of a way to try to buttress your self-image to yourself based on something when you don't have a clear objective means of doing so. So I just wanted to add that piece. I think that's sort of very much in line with what Richard was saying. That's my two cents. And obviously, thank you, Richard and David. That was a great discussion so far.
Ray, is that what you're talking about? Your point makes a lot of sense. Is that what you related to what some people call defense values? That is, things that try to take the place of a genuine value, but are distorted in various ways, or unreal, or irrational.
Yeah. So in psychology, there's even something called defense mechanisms, which are psychological tools of maintaining your sense of self under various stresses in life. A simple example is, something comes up surprising in a conversation that's a little bothersome. You laugh it off. You turn it into a joke, you know, to kind of keep the air light or to keep yourself moving along. So humor would be the example there. But when your whole sense of self is very much in doubt, when you're very unsure whether you're a worthy person and how you could become a worthy person, if it's even possible for you as a person, then you kind of go into emergency mode for a lot of people, and you have to feel like a good person. You have to find some way to defend who you are to to yourself. And you just rely on everything, right? If someone praises you, you hang on to that. If something happens that's momentary, that's positive, you hang on to that. And so you develop this collection of you know, reasons why you might feel good about yourself. And to Richard's point, they're fleeting most often. Because we kind of know, being objectivists, that stability in self-worth kind of has to come from rationality, productiveness, your ability to do things that are measurable, identifiable in the world.
Yeah, and we're so thankful of Ray. Raymond is a practitioner and specialist in psychology, so enormously helpful. Raymond, that you could participate. I found work on, for those interested to study this more, there's about 4 or 5 pages in Brandon's Psychology of Self-Esteem on defense values. And there, here's just a couple of passages. Quote, to the extent a man lacks self-esteem, he lives negatively and defensively. When he chooses his particular values and goals, his primary motive is not to afford himself a positive enjoyment of existence, but to defend himself against anxiety, against painful feelings of inadequacy, self-doubt, and guilt. Now, further down, values chosen in this manner may be termed defense values. A defense value is one motivated by fear and aimed at supporting a pseudo-self-esteem. It's experienced, in effect, as a means of survival, as a substitute for rationality, but it's really an anti-anxiety device. Such a value is unhealthy, not necessarily by virtue of its nature, but by virtue of the motivation for choosing it. Unquote. So defense values. Yeah, interesting concept. I think David and I also, you know, at the tail end of our outline, David, we were talking about how, in a way, the narcissist might deserve some empathy from us because we, you know, we do regard any form of pseudo-individualism or pseudo self-esteem as a vice. But if it's just a manifestation of arrested development, or, you know, the kid damaged goods, so to speak, psychologically from what we know to be broken families and bad parenting, things like that. Now, if that's true, if we have this child going through narcissism and never developing self-esteem and coming into adulthood with narcissism, we have to take into account that kind of stuff. So if it's that the narcissist is at least trying to make something of himself, it's pathetic, it's not realistic, but they're trying to make something of themselves rather than giving up, rather than self-abnegation, you know, rather than quitting. That is admirable to a degree, right? So they're just using the wrong instrument, clearly wrong instruments, but at least they're not giving up. So David, would you agree this is a more benevolent interpretation of what they're doing? I don't want to condemn these people if they haven't gotten outside of their childhood damage yet.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good point, Richard. Richard was a person who, made it originally. I think it was a great insight. And it's significant, I think, because, you know, as you said, Richard, objectivists tend to regard any form of pseudo-individualism or pseudo-self-esteem as a vice and to be judged as such and condemned. Objectivist philosophy includes the ethic of justice, which means judging people by a rational standard.
Yep.
But to be fully rational, I think one should take account of all the relevant circumstances, including the psychological ones. And so there's a kind of shooting from the hip form of judgment that too many objectivists practice. And I think this is a good reminder that, you know, try to understand before you condemn.
Yeah, and in one of the readings, Brummelman said at one point, he was talking about the self-esteem movement in the 60s and 70s, which Brandon contributed to. And I would say, thank goodness there was such a movement. But he said, he had the insight to say, you know, it wasn't fully understood for what it was, which is kind of admitting that it was a new, very new, but that's what Ayn Rand said, a new concept of egoism. And he thought that to the extent you could measure a growing spread of narcissism, his view was it was an unable to comprehend self-esteem. So the oddity there is the assessment was, had there not been a self-esteem movement, there would not have been this kind of twisted interpretation of what self-esteem meant. And we haven't mentioned this tonight, but we're all aware, I'm sure you've heard of the conservatives who will quite rightly say, I'm sick and tired of my kid being told he's the greatest, he's wonderful, everybody gets a trophy. And they use this, we would agree with that, that's fake. But they use it to condemn self-esteem, genuine self-esteem, because, you know, much of this literature says religions are very suspicious of any case for self-esteem, any case for pride. Pride is one of the deadly, isn't it one of the seven deadly sins, David, in Christianity? So when
it's the worst.
When they hear self, let alone self-esteem, they're not inclined to say, oh, please tell me more. How does this Brandon concept work with reason? And no, they want dictates from God and commandments and things like that. So they're not inclined to look nicely upon self-esteem. So they're easily able to latch on to this. Look how goofy self-esteem is being instituted in the schools and stuff like that. It's self-indulgent and, you know, lying to the kids about their possibilities. It's true. They are doing that, but that's not self-esteem. That's not genuine self-esteem. I just wanted to get that on the record.
Well, let's give Connie a chance. She's been patiently waiting. Thanks, Connie.
Well, thank you, Scott. And yeah, very patiently waiting. I thought we were going to wrap this up at 7, so I'm glad that we've got a little more time. And I've just been so impressed that Peggy came here, and I think Peggy should be part of the next talks, or when she gets more comfortable, maybe coming up on stage. She's new to Clubhouse. But my question, actually, just from my background and so forth, is the concept of like ethical egoism and healthcare. And I was curious, Richard and David, what your thoughts are on that. Like, how do you have egoism and altruism and balance that?
Well, Connie, if I understand you right, and tell me if I'm wrong, I have heard this argument before that healthcare and sometimes education and schooling and various other things are classified as caregiving, the caring sectors, so to speak. And that seems, and caring is then conflated with concern for others, and therefore it's seen as a clash, like who would go into that field or do well in that field if they go into it, if they're ethical egoists. Now, before I go on, is that close to what you're thinking, or is that completely off base?
It's not completely off base, but it goes further than that, because
okay.
Part of ethical egoism, I would understand it to be that you need to advocate for that patient, and you need to encourage them to have self-interest in doing well and getting better. So I guess there's two trains of thought I had on that, which I tend to do. I tend to have tons of tabs open. But yeah. It's a person that goes into field, but it's also part of what you do to encourage the patient to have self-interest in, you know, being egoistic and taking care of themselves, and extend that further to those who take care of those, like family members and that sort of thing. So a lot of tabs open there, but you were on the right train.
I like that. In my own field of investments, I'll often be asked, well, what is this? Sounds very similar to doctor-patient. What is this fiduciary duty to the investor So the investor who's not a specialist, they'll come and they'll give you some of their assets and they'll say, please manage my portfolio or manage my estate. And there's a long, well-documented tradition of trustees. Interestingly, they call them trustees. They're trusted advisors. But their self-interest is in, I'm going to serve the client. The client wants me to manage their assets. But the serve part sounds weird, right? Sounds weird to an egoist. What do you mean serving? Yeah, but it's a trader. As David said before, it's the trader principle. You're paying me for a service. I'm a doctor. You're a patient. I want you to recover. I have a self-interest in you recovering. I'm an investment advisor. I have a self-interest in your portfolio appreciating, not depreciating. But there is this kind of, if you're getting to this, Connie, there is this kind of fiduciary, this concept of a fiduciary, a principal agent relationship where the principal owes to the agent certain things. But of course, the agent is paying the principal for that. So I'll stop there. I don't know if you want to add to that, David.
Yeah, I would add one point, maybe on a more general level. Every profession, to the extent that it's productive because it's aiming at to create some kind of value. And there are standards for how to create that value and what the constituents of that value are. So, Connie, in relation to a doctor, patient, or a therapist, client, yes, restoring the patient's health or well-being, self-esteem is, that's your goal. Just I was a teacher for many years. Richard is a teacher. Our goal as teachers is to help our students master a subject and gain knowledge and mental ability. So those are internal goals that define the profession. Each of us chooses the profession that we're in because we enjoy that form of work. And we demand what you might call external rewards, like, first of all, money, of course, but also respect and growth and proper, you know, sense of reputation. But those are the external rewards. The internal goal is always by a standard of, what value am I creating? And that's true whether we're talking about a teacher or a therapist or a guy running, a CEO running a business. He's creating value. That's his standard. And good ones hold to that standard and aim for it.
Great.
It might be interesting to note also, Connie, that the trader principle that Dave and I are talking about, the mutually beneficial relationship. It's interesting that in jurisprudence, when you get to law courts and things like that, there's something called a lawyer-client confidentiality, or doctor-patient confidentiality, where if there's some kind of civil or other suit is being brought, they don't pierce this partnership. It's improper to get in between the lawyer and defendant, you know, the doctor and patient, which is very interesting now, because it signifies in our system, it signifies the importance of this collaborative relationship. It should not be pierced by others, should not be invaded by others, even in a contested civil suit. I think it's similar, by the way, with spouses. Is it true that, I'm pretty sure it's true, spouses cannot testify against the other spouse? So another example of a partnership not to be pierced because it's a partnership, that there's not a conflict between the two, but a partnership, mutually beneficial relationship.
Good. JP?
Thank you. I am dropped by because it's from an article that I read that narcissism can also be traced back to some form of addiction to pleasure hormones like dopamine or even adrenaline, that these people derive from being light. And it's I wanted to ask a person here on how is this Are we living through an epidemic of narcissism in the era of and followers? And how there are also a noticeable in world leaders that are considered narcissists. I mean, the go-to, of course, for everyone, Trump, but I see a whole others. So how to narcissism?
David, do you want to take that, or I'm glad to take it?
Why don't you, Richard? I'm not sure I heard the question accurately.
Okay, JP asked whether narcissism might be seen as something like an addiction, like a drug or some kind, where people get high. Well, not to put words in your mouth, JP. High on, I have more likes this. I have more likes today, and I got more followers and blah, blah, blah. I remember Trump used to obsess about how many people were in the stadium, and the media would get him on. He said, I packed the house and it was standing room only outside, and that kind of thing is like an immediate hit to the, my answer would be something like, if, I don't know those studies, but they sound plausible in the following sense. To the extent narcissism is non-rational, it's not an objective rational basis for your self-esteem. And then it's going to be reliant on others, you know, coming and going, so to speak, into your orbit, affirming or not affirming, approving or not approving, criticizing or flattering you. It sounds more sensationalist. I don't mean since, I mean in the sense of a sensation, an ephemeral, fleeting, emotional thing, like a drug. And so that sounds right to me. If it's been characterized that way, it wouldn't surprise me. And of course, an addiction to anything like that is obviously not rational either. But thoughts, David, the idea of addictiveness in narcissism. I'm not sure we came across that, but it seems plausible to me.
Well, yeah, in a sense, at least in terms of similarity. But my understanding of addiction is that it has a specific medical and psychological definition involving physical dependence, accommodation to a substance, for example, like alcohol or tobacco or whatever, drug. And we should be careful about broadening it too much to any kind of enjoyment that we chronically pursue. I mean, I love, you know, working with Richard, for example. I could, you know, we could talk all day, and I wouldn't run out of interest. So is that an addiction? No, it's just, you know, I love doing that. And I'm just issuing a kind of a cautionary note about, you know, taking addiction as a term that has a specific meaning, and broadening it to apply way outside its field.
But the version I hear at JP, maybe you think it's a, I agree with that, David. But if it's like physiological, you're feeling, yeah, that's more like an addiction. You know, when people say things like, you tell the kids, we're going to go off grid the following week, the family's going to take a vacation in the mountains, and the kids go nuts. The kids can't do it. Put down the iPhone, stop visiting Facebook. And so in measures like that, where you see people going through withdrawals, so to speak, it's really painful for them not to check in with their this and that social media. Maybe that's what you're thinking of, JP? There is that phenomenon. Does sound like, yeah?
Yeah, there's studies that are characterizing our times as being an epidemic of narcissism personality disorder because of the induced dopamine hits that get from the followers.
Yeah. I actually searched us having seen that phrase epidemic narcissist epidemic. I looked it up, and there's even a book called The Narcissism Epidemic, subtitled Living in an Age of Entitlement, which is interesting. But it was written in 2009, So that's that is long before, I think, I think the iPhone was introduced in 2008. So interestingly, and that was done by two academics, that book. So they measured and found a rise in narcissism, I think, from like 1979 to 2008. So however, this has been going on for a while, and the idea whether it's an epidemic or not, I don't know, but that language does come up. If you put down, if you look up narcissism as an epidemic, which sounds like it's addictive, that does exist. That study does exist.
May I comment on this one?
Raymond, I do want to give Fred a chance as well.
Go ahead, Fred.
Go ahead, Raymond. You wanted to say something quickly?
No, it's not essential. I think
all right, well, we'll go to Fred and we'll come back to you if we have time.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Fred.
Non-expert, non-amateur. I came in a little late. I caught up at the tail end of a conversation about objectivist. I don't know if you guys meant objective, some kind of objectivist therapies or coping mechanisms for narcissism. Or is that what I thought I heard?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah, because I was wondering if a narcissist can be expected to be objective or rational, especially in dealing with the disorder. I guess that's my question for comments.
Well, I think our view would be objectivity is the way out of this error, the way out of this condition, which is not in your self-interest. So but when you say coping mechanism, I do know in psychology, coping mechanism is almost like, well, I must be a narcissist. Now, how do I handle it? How do I put up with it? I can't rid myself of it. So I need mechanisms to live with it. But that we already talked about that. Those are what's called defense values. And they do defend yourself, so to speak, which is better than sacrificing yourself, but they're not psychologically healthy. So, I'll stop there.
I think this would be a good point to ask Ray, who is a practicing psychiatrist and probably has some insight from theory and experience on this. Ray?
I think very much what Richard was saying. Many people with narcissistic tendencies do improve and get themselves out of the situation, sometimes with help of professionals, sometimes even on their own. A big part of it is being honest with yourself, gaining an objective measure of who you are, deciding to be honest about what your achievements have been or failures have been, and to build successes from here on out in whatever way you can that are true and objective. So, I think objectivity is an important part of the solution.
I'm sorry. I thought you were going to respond, but questions myself. I'm trying to just summarize it myself as the point of the advocates of self-sacrifice to kind of conflate narcissism with egoism to kind of make people feel bad about pursuing their own values.
I'm not sure it's motivated, Scott, by those who advocate self-sacrifice. It might be, the real truly, vicious types who want no egoism at all. I don't know. I think it's more benign than that. I think at least what I'm saying, David, you tell me if it's different. I think this is an issue of mischaracterizing a true, important ethical theory and practice, rational egoism. And just like capitalism, objectivity, egoism, all the key justice, like why we could have a whole session on why social justice is not justice. Why would we do that? Because justice is so important We don't want it contaminated by these path, what our colleague Jason Hill calls idea pathogens. But what's interesting about narcissism is an actual real psychological, it's in the handbooks. It's a disorder. They do call it a disorder. They don't call it orderly or proper. And I don't know. That's my best argument, Scott, that we're trying to distinguish and therefore defend and promote. It's an opportunity to promote, hey, here's a better way. Narcissism is not rational egoism, but most people don't know what rational egoism is. Here's our chance. Here's a wonderful chance to convey it. And as I said before in the elevator pitch argument, I think most people know what narcissism is and feel uncomfortable with it and don't like it, but they don't know what our position is. Is that fair, David, or would you put it differently?
Yeah, I would just maybe though, you know, people who are card-carrying altruists or who are implicitly influenced by that moral standard, which most people in society are, will tend to misidentify what is and is not egoistic. And there are a number of myths about it. Mm-hmm. You've written a whole essay on that. Among the ones I would mention is that, one is that egoists have to be self-centered, narcissistic, yeah, vain, et cetera.
Yeah.
Another one is that they're exploitative, rapacious, yeah, cruel, power, yeah, hungry, or, yeah, another one altogether is that egoists are materialistic. They're only concerned with money, sex, possessions. They don't have, yeah, any spiritual life. And, yeah, all of those are myths about,
yeah,
egoism, misrepresentations that come out of a distorted, you know, sense of what egoism and altruism are. So I think there is some kind of motivation here, or maybe just a misconception.
And also relevant, David, the concept of Ayn Rand calling it the package deal. So someone says, yeah, oh, I hear you guys are egoists over, you objectivists are egoists. Oh, well, who's this Donald Trump character? I mean, that's what was that, an Ayn Rand character? And if so, objectivism sucks. Because Donald Trump sucks. I'm not saying they're that crude about it, but that's the risk you run. You run the risk of jamming all these things together into one package, and they're incommensurable. And that's why I think David and I focus so much also, the more we studied this, on the issue of this is not an issue quantitative, but qualitative. This is a difference to narcissism versus ego. It's a difference not of... number, but kind, not of degree, but of kind, fundamentally different, not belonging in the same package.
All right. Well, let's go to Clark. Clark?
Yes. Thank you, David and Richard, for this very, very interesting presentation. I just have kind of a tangential point about Donald Trump. I've always viewed him as a 76-year-old white rapper, and all that entails. I mean, most of his supporters, when you think about it, are kind of lower middle class, you know, white males who, you know, are constantly told they're racist. You know, they're making $40,000 a year. And I mean, they don't understand that the antidote to all the heavy wokeism is ideas, fundamental ideas. But, you know, again, we live in an anti-ideas society. So they don't see that. So, you know, they gravitate toward this narcissist like Trump. So I suppose in a better world, you know, where people actually read the critiques of postmodernism that, you know, Professor Hicks has written on, and even, you know, Professors Kelly and Salzman, just in the Atlas Society alone, we have all the ideas to completely demolish all this wokeism. But obviously, you know, in America today, millions of people don't think, you know, they think ideas are some kind of a liberal social construct. And so they gravitate to this, you know, someone like Trump. And I mean, I guess it can't be all bad. I mean, they really aren't racist. Millions of Americans really aren't racist, but they're called this every day. So, you know, they don't know how to what the antidote is, the real antidote ideas. So they're just gravitated to this Donald Trump guy, and that's why he, I think, was so successful.
You make a good point, and if what you're saying is that there's a plausibility to a defense of Trump, and I think there's some to the Americans like a self-confident, unvarnished achiever, here a real estate developer, puts his names right on the buildings. I remember him asked one time, why do you put your names on the buildings? And he said, because I built them. And that people love that. And I think objectivists should say the good part of Donald Trump is people are seeing achievement and they're seeing unabashed, unapologetic. Now, the part where it veers off into narcissism, of course, we would get off the train. But let's not say the guy is a complete narcissist. It seems a mixture of narcissism and genuinely earned. He's certainly earned self-esteem. I heard someone make a distinction once, which is very interesting. They said they did not anticipate the chattering class. They did not anticipate Trump's following and success because they took him literally, but not seriously. And the electorate who voted for him took him seriously, but not literally. So the first could not believe that he would possibly be electable. But the ones who voted for him, you know, didn't take him literally. Every single silly thing he said took literally. But they took him seriously. They knew what parts of him meant what he said. And that might be an important distinction. Is that what you're getting at, Clark? That there's something in Trump that's genuine and that people respond to. It's not, you know, fake narcissism all the way through.
Right, right. In other words, a lot of his voters, of course, are in a better world, I guess, you know, maybe he wouldn't be nearly as big as he is now. But of course, we don't live yet in that better world because all this wokeism, all this political correctness, and yet the masses that support him, you know, they don't think they're racist. Well, they know they're not. And yet, you know, they see someone like Trump who never apologizes. I mean, I guess if he started, you know, I can't even imagine a kinder, gentler Trump. I mean, it's like a contradiction in terms. And so instead of being attracted to, you know, real ideas that show, you know, that all this wokeism is really, you know, invalid, they just latch on to this, you know, kind of, I see your point too. I mean, he is in some ways genuinely egoistic, you know, not really rationally egoistic, but there's, it's not all bad. Obviously it's not all good, but it's not all bad either.
Good. Thank you, Clark.
When he speaks to the woke people, it's in your face.
Yeah. The pugnacious, combative Trump, as Clark put it, you know, versus the craven, triple apologizing, these people who are appeasing, that's a real contrast. And if part of him is narcissism, they're like, who cares? At least he's fighting back.
That's what I was going to ask. At a certain point of the establishment getting corrupt, does it almost take a certain amount of narcissism to
enjoy it? What's interesting about him is if we're right about the narcissist, if the literature is right about the narcissist, they actually care too much about what other people think. And that does not seem true of Trump, although we might eventually see that, you know, that he's becomes dispirited himself and less energetic on the campaign trail and all that kind of thing. When his support withers. So that'll be revealed. I mean, to put it this way also, why did they kick him off Twitter? You know, the idea about misinformation and stuff, I think, was wrong. But it's almost as if Twitter under Jack Dorsey knew that this guy so craved attention, and he did have more followers than anyone else on Twitter, right? That would really crush him. That he, if you took his voice away and his followers, You know, so it's as if Twitter said, we know this guy's a narcissist. We know what fuels him is this. So let's take away his fuel. And we do hear stories behind the scenes of him being kind of isolated down in Mar-a-Lago and not getting the energy that he would from daily tweeting, daily combativeness with the media, rallies, all those kind of things. They energize him.
Right. Well, this has been a great session, David. I'm glad we got your sound going early. I just wanted to mention real quickly, we've got some big events next week, next Wednesday across all our channels. Stephen Hicks and Robert Trzezinski will be talking about the philosophy of history at 5 p.m. Eastern. And then 1 week from today, Richard will be back here on Clubhouse at 6 p.m. Eastern with an Ask Me Anything. Looking forward to that. Again, thanks to everyone who participated and joined us, and to David and Richard. And we'll see you again next week.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, David.
Thanks, all. Richard, Scott, everyone.